Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
I am a golden god!
You can't handle the truth!
I am the father.
Bond. James Bond.
Get to the chopper!
I'd buy that for a dollar.
Get off my plane.
You talking to me?
Say hello to my little friend!
Yeah, I'm thinking I'm back.
It's alive!
This is producer Josh's Film School.
This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
Game over, man. It's game over.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Producer Josh's Film School. I am Producer Josh. Thanks for clicking play on this episode. Tonight we are going to talk about The Matrix, the 1999 sci-fi action blockbuster. Turns 25 years old this week, so we're going to celebrate the way we do here on Producer Josh's Film School. We will relive some of the best moments of the movie, crown some superlatives, and of course give you some fun movie trivia along the way. You can follow me on social media on Instagram at Josh Odson, on Twitter at producer_Josh. Let's dive right into it. We got a lot to cover. And of course, at the end of the episode, we'll tell you what to expect on the next episode of Producer Josh's Film School and where you can watch that movie right now. We begin with some of the new stuff that I've been watching before we dive into The Matrix. Little palate cleanser, a little teaser here before we get into the meat of the matter. An appetizer, if you will. I've talked about this on the Connor Happer Show quite a bit. Weekdays, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on 1620 The Zone, by the way. 1620thezone.com or on YouTube worldwide there. The Roadhouse reboot. You can watch it on Amazon Prime right now. Stars Jake Gyllenhaal, co-stars UFC fighter Conor McGregor. A lot of people have asked me about this. Yes, I agree. The movie should not exist. No, I don't think any of the... I'm so used to these bad reboots that I don't think it's blasphemous anymore. Like, there's no piece of IP other than, like, The Godfather that I think is untouchable to Hollywood producers nowadays. Like, the only thing I would ever be outraged about by a remake or a reboot is The Godfather. Everything else, like, okay, sure. You know, everything's been touched or gonna be touched. Probably don't touch The Godfather, okay? So I understand people get outraged, but I'm just kind of used to these bad, crappy remakes. This isn't terrible, and I say that with a little bit of a grain of salt, because let's take a step back. Let's view this from, you know, 3,000 feet in the air. The original Roadhouse, while awesome, is not any piece of high art that we should be protective of at all costs, okay? The original Roadhouse works because you, the viewer, believe Patrick Swayze believes he is Dalton. Not, oh, Patrick Swayze's playing a cool badass in this movie. No, Patrick Swayze in that movie believes in his heart he is Dalton. As for this new version, I don't know that Jake Gyllenhaal thinks of anything. He seems like kind of a vapid dude, if you ask me. But he clearly went through a body transformation for this movie, something he's done before with what was Southpaw and a couple other movies where he's had to take his shirt off, if nothing else. But the action sequences are really good. They're a little overproduced. They want you to know that these were all filmed in like one take or with a circle of cameras around the fight, because they're going to show it off. It's got this dry wit to it, like a sense of humor, like a 90s action movie where the Jake Gyllenhaal punch you in the face and then he'll say a funny line and it'll be super entertaining because we did both of those things. Yeah, that's what this movie does. And it works more often than it doesn't, the fight scenes, that is. it doesn't have a lot of like Easter eggs or nods to the original Roadhouse. So I'm not really sure what the point was. Again, this movie shouldn't exist, but it does. So let's take it at face value. I was prepared for like, okay, this is going to be one of the worst movies of the year because it shouldn't exist and it's going to be bad or lazy. I don't think the movie's lazy. I think it earnestly tries to do Roadhouse for a new generation of people who may have never seen Roadhouse. Like I think that's who this movie's intended for. It's not intended for fans of Roadhouse. It's intended for people who stream movies and have never watched the original from, God, what would that be, 40 years ago? Yeah. 2.5 stars for Roadhouse from me. I was surprised at how much I didn't hate it. Now, that's not, I was not surprised at how much I liked it. I was, note the differentiation there. I was surprised at how much I didn't hate it. If you held a gun to my head and made me say thumbs up or thumbs down, I guess because of the surprise, I would go thumbs up, but it would be close. I gave it 2.5 out of 5 stars. I went right down the middle with it. Because you know it kind of salvages itself. Like it's certainly not boring at any point, and that's a movie's cardinal sin. If you are boring, you're gonna lose me, and you're gonna lose me quick. Don't be boring. Roadhouse isn't boring. Let's find that piece of common ground with each other, okay? And then the other new movie I want to review before we get to The Matrix is Immaculate. It is a horror movie starring Sidney Sweeney. Sidney Sweeney is a nun, perfect casting. She's a nun who, leaves America for Italy and, she becomes pregnant. I don't think that's a spoiler. I mean, the movie's called Immaculate. What did you think it was in reference to? Hint, hint, it's the Immaculate Conception. So therefore, it's a mystery about who the baby daddy is. And you think it's going to be a Rosemary's Baby knockoff, and then it isn't. Okay, I don't want to spoil anything. If you go see Immaculate, don't do any research beforehand. Go in as blind as possible. It's a quick movie. I said it was under 90 minutes, and then I looked at it, and I think it was 88 minutes, so I was right there. Like, it's real short. It moves quick. It also was never boring. Now, here's the thing about Immaculate. Now, I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth here. I told you to go in as blind as possible, and then I'm going to tell you, no spoilers, but the third act gets cuckoo bananas crazy, which is why you should go in as blind as possible. But if you're pressing on with this podcast, let me tell you, again, cuckoo bananas crazy third act, and then the last, I don't know, 3 minutes is even more cuckoo bananas crazy. It's going to be pretty divisive. It's a lot. Let's say that. Again, I'm trying to make sure I don't spoil this movie for anyone. I don't even know if it's a good ending or a bad ending, but it is a choice. Let me tell you that. And Sidney Sweeney was a producer on this movie, so she had a hand in said choice. I think it's making a statement about women's health issues, if I had to guess. Don't think things about me because I liked this movie. I liked that it, quote-unquote, went there. It's not me agreeing or disagreeing with the message of the movie, but I did like that it was A, never boring, B, really, like, quick. Connor and I, if you've listened to us on the Connor Happer Show, we are violently advocating to bring back 90-minute movies. There's no reason movies need to be 2.5 hours anymore. I think The Roadhouse was like 2 hours and 15 minutes, and doesn't need to be, okay? Get in, get out, let's get on with it, okay? 90 minutes, I liked that. I liked that it was never boring. I've seen Sydney Sweeney in like four movies, and I'm not really sure if she's a good actress or not. So I'm leaning towards that she's not a good actress. I don't know what anyone else thinks about her. Like, she's obviously very, like, physically attractive and all that sort of thing. But I liked this movie. It got really weird. It got really violent. And fun isn't the right word, but I enjoyed myself watching this movie. I gave it 3.5 out of 5 stars, which is a pretty good review. Not quite a great movie, but a good movie. And I think it's here's what it is. You know, I'm thinking out loud. Yes, absolutely. I should have more concise thoughts. That's why these pods go so long, is because I just turn the microphone on and I start talking to myself. I didn't have very high expectations going in. I just heard, hey, there's a third act twist that you don't want spoiled. If you know this about me, you know I'm generally in on a horror movie. There's a couple subgenres of horror that I'm out on, but more times than not, like 7 out of 10 times, 8 out of 10 times, oh, there's a new horror movie? I'll watch that. I find it entertaining. I can turn my brain off and just kind of know the beats of every subgenre of a horror movie. Because, you know, every horror movie about religion is the same. Every horror movie about a killer doll is the same. Every slasher is the same. Every zombie movie is essentially the same. So I can kind of turn my brain off and enjoy it. What I liked about Immaculate was I didn't go in thinking like, okay, this is going to be the best movie in the world. I just went and saw it because I heard that I didn't want to have it spoiled. So I'm like, okay, I got to move this up on the watch list because like it was this or Ghostbusters. Like I was planning fully on having a new Ghostbusters review for everyone in this episode. And I don't, because I read that Immaculate had a third act spoiler that you don't want to have spoiled for you. I don't know if it's that big of a spoiler. Like it's an enjoyable twist. And then there's a twist at the very, very, very end, less enjoyable, but shocking. If you're a fan of horror movies, I would say go see this. Give it a try. I'm not saying go see it, you'll like it. I'm saying it's worth a watch. I'm curious what quote-unquote normal people think, like normal moviegoers. I've read opinions from movie critics, and there's a number of Christian advocacy groups that are vehemently against this movie, and that makes sense. Not unfounded, their claims here, but... So I've read opinions from movie critics and advocacy groups. I'm kind of interested in what like regular old moviegoers think about Immaculate. If you go see Roadhouse you don't have to go see Roadhouse. You can sit on your couch at home and watch Roadhouse. That's on Amazon Prime. Immaculate's in the theaters. I don't anticipate Immaculate being in theaters for long, maybe 3 weeks, and then you could probably rent it at home. 3.5 stars. Out of Immaculate. I said that already, but I'll say it again just in case you missed it. All right, now we dive deep into The Matrix. We begin with the basics, released on March 31st, 1999. That means it is celebrating its 25th anniversary this week. I picked the movie for that reason. I also picked it because as we are recording this, I don't know when you're listening to it, but it is Holy Week. Is Easter weekend, and those themes of Easter and the Matrix, if you choose to believe, do sort of sync up. So some fun there, fun being a loose word there. Directed by the Wachowskis, that is what we will call them. They were the Wachowski brothers when this movie was made. They now identify as females, which... I don't really want to get into that. Odd that it's come up for a second pod in a row after Ace Ventura last week. Before The Matrix, the Wachowskis, they had one film to their resume, and it was Bound, which is a nice little movie if you've ever seen it. Off the success of that, they had the script for The Matrix. They took it to Warner Brothers, and they said, here, you think we're a hot commodity. We want to direct this. This is our script. We want this. So they were allowed to do that based off the success of Bound with Jennifer Tilly, Gina Gershon, and Joe Pantoliano, who's going to come up here in this episode. 83% on Rotten Tomatoes, thanks to the critics. 85% from the audience on Rotten Tomatoes. So the audience likes it a little more than the critics. The consensus on Rotten Tomatoes, thanks to the Wachowskis' imaginative vision, The Matrix is a smartly crafted combination of spectacular action and groundbreaking special effects. The cast, obviously, Keanu Reeves, who had been in Speed, was probably his biggest movie to date. Carrie Ann Moss, who had done a bunch of indie movies. Nobody had really heard of her. She wasn't a nobody, but mainstream audiences hadn't really heard of her yet. Obviously, Lawrence Fishburne, who audiences were very familiar with. Joe Pantoliano, obviously audiences were familiar with. Pretty Woman would probably be the biggest thing he had done since then. That was a pretty big movie in the early 90s. IMDb, 8.7 out of 10 is the score there. That is the 17th highest rated movie on the Internet Movie Database of all time. That's right, 17th highest of all time. 73% on Metacritic, A minus from CinemaScore, where they hand you a little index card opening weekend and you hand it back to them after the movie. I can't imagine you would click play without having seen this movie, but if you haven't, here is the plot from Google. Neo, Keanu Reeves, believes that Morpheus, Lawrence Fishburne, an elusive figure considered to be the most dangerous man alive, can answer his question. What is the Matrix? Neo is contacted by Trinity, Carrie Ann Moss, a beautiful stranger who leads him into an underworld where he meets Morpheus. They fight in a brutal battle for their lives against a cadre of viciously intelligent secret agents. It is a truth that could cost Neo something more precious than his life. Okay, we dive into the numbers, the box office numbers for The Matrix. It debuted at number one with $27.7 million opening weekend. It knocked out the movie Forces of Nature with Ben Affleck and Sandra Bullock. We'll get to this later. Sandra Bullock was a choice for the Neo character, yes, and the Trinity character in early casting decisions for The Matrix. Obviously, they did not go with either of those, and she went elsewhere. If you've ever seen Forces of Nature, I'm shocked it debuted at number one. Obviously, Ben Affleck and Sandra Bullock were a huge pairing, but that movie's trash, yo. Same opening weekend as 10 Things I Hate About You. What an opening weekend. The Matrix and 10 Things I Hate About You. What a banger weekend at the box office. Second weekend, still number one, $22.5 million, down just 18.8%. A good second weekend drop-off is 50% nowadays. And The Matrix went down just 18.8%. So great word of mouth. Also important to note, the second weekend The Matrix was out was Easter weekend. Again, Easter themes, Christianity in this movie. New movies at the box office for The Matrix's second weekend, Never Been Kissed, another kind of classic starring Drew Barrymore. So March and April, kind of impressive months in 1999. Third weekend, it dips to number two with $17.9 million. It was defeated by the Eddie Murphy comedy Life, which that's a solid movie. That's a solid movie. It did $20 million that weekend. So Matrix was a close number two. Fourth weekend, Matrix back at number one. It pushes Life to number two. The Matrix does $12.6 million in its fourth weekend to regain the number one spot. And then in the fifth weekend, it goes to number two permanently. I guess not number one permanently. Never was number one again. Number two in its fifth weekend with $8.7 million. The number one movie that weekend, it was a new movie. It earned $20 million that weekend. Entrapment with Sean Connery and Catherine Zeta-Jones, which was a big movie at the time, but nobody really talks about Entrapment anymore. I think the word Entrapment was made popular, and that's about it. That's about the staying power of Entrapment. Is just that word. People yell entrapment when somebody's trying to, you know, pull a fast one on them. Like, entrapment! That's entrapment! Domestic box office, $171 million. Global box office, $463 million. It was the fourth highest grossing film of the year, 1999, behind number three, Toy Story 2. Okay, that makes sense. Number two, The Sixth Sense. Yeah, that was a pretty popular movie. And number one, Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, which, hey, that's coming back into theaters this year. So we can all relive the fun of Senate hearings in outer space and that one cool pod racing scene. Okay, as we dive into the production and the making of this movie, I guess let's start with some of the casting what-ifs. Those are one of the most fun things to me. And then we'll get into like the really like dialed-in details of this movie and how it got made. Keanu Reeves obviously played Neo. I think it's pretty well known. Hey, Will Smith was going to play Neo. He didn't get the concept of the movie. He didn't get the subject matter, so he bowed out, made Wild Wild West instead, which was a choice. And so they had to go look elsewhere. Also, before we get off of Will Smith, he said, I couldn't have done it as well as Keanu did. Keanu did great, like no hard feelings. I would have messed it up, he said. I wasn't mature enough as an actor to do The Matrix when I was asked to do The Matrix. Nicolas Cage turned down the role due to family obligations. Would have loved to have seen that version. I got to be honest with myself. Warner Brothers wanted Brad Pitt and Val Kilmer to be in this movie. Both declined. Leonardo DiCaprio was then pursued to play Neo, but he said, hey, just did this big effects movie called Titanic. Don't want to do big effects movies. I don't want to do big blockbusters back to back because then I'm a blockbuster guy and I don't see myself as a blockbuster guy. I see myself as a thespian. Yeah, he made the right choice there. You know, I think Leo can do anything, by the way, but yeah, his reasoning is right. He would have been Tom Cruise and never respected as a serious actor. He would have been shoehorned into an action franchise. And then it might have parlayed to like, gosh, they only cast me in action movies because they don't take me seriously as an actor. Then would Leo have had to take like a role in the MCU or something like that? I see him as like a Sebastian Stan, like a Bucky sort of character. You know, Bucky sort of broods like Leo, but I digress. And I'm trying to digress less. If you like the digressions, let me know, so I'll keep doing it. After Leo, they went to Johnny Depp was the studio's choice. One of the screenwriters said, what about Sandra Bullock and we make Neo a female? Okay, that's bold. Hadn't thought of that. I don't know if the Trinity character would have become a man. Like, I don't know. I don't have those notes in front of me. I wasn't a part of making The Matrix, okay? But it essentially came down to Johnny Depp or Keanu Reeves, and spoiler alert for later in this podcast, you had to understand The Matrix backwards and forwards to be cast in this movie. And the Wachowskis said, Keanu Reeves just got it. He understood it. He understood the philosophy of the movie better than Johnny Depp. So they picked him, even though the studio was like, Johnny Depp, go Johnny. Maybe you go Johnny Depp. And the studio said, no, for this to be a good movie, you have to understand the subject matter. And Keanu does that in a way that Johnny Depp doesn't. So they picked Johnny Depp. Early choices for Trinity. Let's do Trinity here. Early choices for Trinity, the most interesting one, there were a lot of people who auditioned or tried out. Janet Jackson was initially approached for the role, but scheduling conflicts prevented her from accepting it. That's not like a lot of these where, they turned it down because they didn't get it. Janet Jackson was going to do this, and she was going to play Trinity, but she didn't have the time in her schedule. In an interview, she stated that turning down the role was difficult, so she referenced The Matrix in the intro and outro interludes for her album Discipline. Sandra Bullock, who was previously approached for the role of Neo, was then offered the role of Trinity, and it would have been a Keanu Reeves-Sandra Bullock team up, you know, Speed, it would have been playing off of like, oh, you loved them in Speed, come see them in The Matrix. Sandy B turned it down. Then they went to Rosie Perez, Salma Hayek, and Jada Pinkett Smith, Will Smith's wife. People forget. Yeah, I did not keep her name out of my mouth. I understand that. They auditioned for the role. The Wachowskis ultimately picked Carrie Ann Moss for the role. And yes, Jada Pinkett Smith would obviously go on to play Niobe in some of the sequels. Early casting decisions for Morpheus, Gary Oldman, Samuel L. Jackson, that just makes sense, and Val Kilmer were also considered for the part. Everybody really wanted Val Kilmer in this movie, and they were determined to put Val Kilmer in this movie, and it just didn't happen. Okay, so those are all the fun casting what-ifs I have for you. Let's get into kind of how this movie was made. Not as long and arduous as a process as you would have thought, because the Wachowskis meticulously planned this movie. They had comic book artists draw a 600-page shot-by-shot storyboard for the entire film because studio executives, they liked the text, but they couldn't really grasp, like, okay, what is this going to look like? What kind of movie are you making? We like it, but we don't trust it. We don't trust you. Can you hold our hand and kind of show us what this movie is going to look like? But before that, 1994, the Wachowskis write a script for Warner Brothers called Assassins. I have not fact-checked this. I believe this is the Sylvester Stallone movie Assassins. Feel free to look that up on your own and fact-check me. That movie goes well, so the Wachowskis are allowed to direct Bound, as I said. And because of the success of Assassins, and they were a hot commodity before they agreed to direct Bound. Assassins hits a little bit at the box office. People like the writing, even if the movie wasn't a huge hit. So they sign a two-picture deal with Warner Brothers. The first movie they're contracted to make is Bound. The second is The Matrix. So it comes time to direct The Matrix. They have the script, they have the storyboards, they have the cast. They hand the cast multiple books. One from French philosopher, going to butcher this name, Jean Baudrillard, Simulacra and Simulation. Required reading for the principal cast and crew. Everyone involved in this movie, again, had to know The Matrix inside and out. Keanu Reeves read it. They gave him more books. They gave him Kevin Kelly's Out of Control, The New Biology of Machines, Social Systems, and the Economic World. They gave him Dylan Evans' Ideas on Evolutionary Psychology. And eventually, you had to... The way it sounds to me is you had to essentially regurgitate those themes, those ideas back to the Wachowskis, and then they gave you the script. Yeah, what a lot of work. I mean, I guess it's just reading three books, but just to meticulously comprehend those big, heady ideas and then get your script. Like, what a commitment. And then we'll get into this, the physical training for the movie. This was a huge undertaking as an actor. It's way more than the script being thrown at you and just, yeah, you know, squawk those lines back at me like a parrot like you normally do. Carrie Ann Moss said she had difficulty understanding the material, but she ultimately, you know, they told her, like, you have to if you want to be in this movie. So she did, but she said it was really, really hard for her. The directors, the Wachowskis, loved John Woo movies. The 1999, off the top of my head, I'm not sure. John Woo, yes, he had to have done American movies by this point. But his movies back home, pull some of those up sometime. Those are amazing action choreography. They wanted to do that in America. They would, like, hey, John Woo, they fully admitted that he's going to be a huge influence on the action choreography, the fight scenes of this movie. Ghost in the Shell and Akira, a couple of anime movies that are pretty popular, they told the comic book artists and the storyboarders and the crew and the special effects team, they showed them that and they said, we want to do that, but in real life. This is not an animated movie. We want to do that in real life. That's what we're going to do. That's our plan. Fast forward to the visual effects of the movie. Probably the most known for visual effect of this movie is the bullet time. We all call it bullet time, right? Like that's what it popularized. It allows a shot to progress in slow motion while the camera appears to move through the scene at a normal speed. The method used for creating these effects involved a technically expanded version of an old art photography technique known as time slice photography, in which an array of cameras are placed around an object and triggered simultaneously. Each camera captures a still picture, contributing one frame to the video sequence, which creates the effect of virtual camera movement, the illusion of a viewpoint moving around an object that appears frozen in time. So that's the bullet time. That's the thing, the visual style this movie is best known for unleashing upon the world. Everybody had a bullet time parody. Shrek had a bullet time parody. Charlie's Angels, Scary Movie. You couldn't make a movie that, like, oh, this'll play for big laughs. Let's put bullet time in the movie, which is shocking in hindsight, but I mean, movies still do it to this day. They still do bullet time. Training for the physical stuff, like the kung fu, the karate, whatever you want to call it, 4 months of training, of physical fighting training, which they were told it would be 2 weeks. They said maybe 4 at the most, and it was 4 months. This was a grueling movie to be a part of, and all these years later, 25 years later, everybody involved in that movie speaks so highly of it, speaks so highly of making that movie, you know, everyone who could, quote unquote, come back for the sequels and the whatever the hell you want to call the fourth one. By the way, I hate the sequels to this movie. They are all garbage. The second one has a cool car chase in it. That's about it. Those movies are a waste of time, to say the least. If you love them, that's great. I don't. So let me just bare my soul to you for that before we get into it towards the end of the pod here. I loathe the Matrix sequels. I'm choking back anger as we speak because I merely uttered their existence. We get to the trivia of the movie. All the scenes that take, there's a ton of Easter eggs in this movie, which is great. I love that. It rewards rewatching, this movie does, in a way that very few movies do. All scenes that take place within the Matrix have a green tint to them, as if watching them through a computer monitor, because those are green still. Scenes in the real world have a blue tint. Blue was used at a minimum within the Matrix since the directors thought blue was more of a real-world color, despite ironically blue being often the least occurring color in nature. The fight scene between Morpheus and Neo, which is neither in the real world nor in the Matrix, is tinted yellow. The studio insisted on a great deal of explanatory dialogue as they described the screenplay as the script nobody understands. There had to be a lot of exposition. They have to repeat what's going on and what's going to happen a lot in this movie, and they do in a way that doesn't feel forced. At least to me, it doesn't feel forced. It does feel like they're repeating it, but it's also, it feels very helpful is what it is. Many Hollywood studio executives passed on this project, claiming virtual reality sci-fi was bad business, citing Johnny Mnemonic's failure as the reason. Keanu Reeves starred in both The Matrix and Johnny Mnemonic. Johnny Mnemonic is a great bad movie. You have Dolph Lundgren as, what is he? Is he God or is he a pastor in that movie? I forget. There's he's a pastor because the dolphin is God, if I remember right. Henry Rollins is a great character in Johnny Mnemonic. Seriously, Johnny Mnemonic, great bad movie. Lawrence Fishburne said that the movie was too smart to be made, but he went along with it anyway. He figured the plug would get pulled in a matter of days, but he went along with it as long as he could, and he loved it. He described his own character like Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader rolled into one, and I can't say I disagree. That's a good comp, actually. In Greek mythology, Morpheus is the god of dreams, which is ironic, considering Morpheus's role is to awaken people from their dream states within the Matrix. A lot of people did their own stunts, including Carrie Ann Moss, resulted in the twisting of her ankle while shooting one of the scenes. She decided not to tell anyone until after the movie was done filming because she didn't want to get fired. She wasn't a big star at the time, and I don't think she ever was a huge star. She was kind of like a trendy internet girl for a little while after this movie, but I don't think she ever popped to become like a huge star or anything. Obviously, this movie did great for her, but she was worried, like, I'm just an indie actress. There's all these megawatt stars around me. They're going to fire me in an instant. So if they find out I'm hurt, I'm injured, and I can't film, they're just going to fire me. So she did it on essentially one foot. According to the inscription on the Nebuchadnezzar's core, the ship was made in the USA in the year 2069. It also states that it is a Mark III number 11 model, which I don't think it's too much of an intellectual leap to go, okay, what does the Bible verse Mark 3:11 say? Well, let me tell you. And whenever those possessed by evil spirits caught sight of him, they would fall down in front of him, shrieking, "You are the Son of God," which, boy, that sure seems like the plot of The Matrix. Couldn't possibly be a coincidence, right? The Oracle reveals many things in that scene. One of you, Neo or Morpheus, is going to die. Check. She tells Neo, "You got the gift, but it looks like you're waiting for something, your next life maybe." Neo dies and is resurrected, a lot like Jesus in the Bible. The quote proves to be true at the ending of the movie. After Neo is killed by Smith, Trinity gets to resurrect him, finally turning him into the One. The lobby shootout, which has become infamous for several reasons, it took 10 days to film. There's a lot of instances in doing research for this that, oh, this scene took 6 days to film. This scene took 4 days to film, which I don't know how long the total shoot was. I guess I should have looked that up, but I mean, those are long. Those are long shoots, you know, generally a scene a day, like not unheard of to get multiple scenes in a day if you have an actor or a director that likes to work really quickly. And of course, in 2012, The Matrix was selected by the U.S. Library of Congress for preservation in the National Film Registry. For being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. That's movie came out in 1999, and in 2012 it got inducted. That's a pretty quick turnaround, like 12, 13 years out, and they're already like, okay, this movie is significant enough. We have to preserve it for future generations. This movie is credited with widely popularizing the DVD. I know that's kind of difficult to wrap your head around in 2024. Like, okay, what was the movie that popularized the DVD? Everyone had this DVD. After its DVD release, it was the first DVD to ever sell more than 1 million copies. By 2000, remember, this movie came out in 1999, the film went on to become the first DVD to sell more than 3 million copies in the U.S. At that point, it became the top-selling DVD of all time. It held on to that for just a few months before it was passed by Gladiator. Both of those would be quote-unquote guy movies. Dudes had some DVDs on their shelf, right? Like, I owned a ton of DVDs. Still do, by the way. Love me some physical media still. That's right. I'm a sucker. But back in the day, even guys who, colloquially guys, like the royal we, guys, people, humans, even if they only had like six DVDs, The Matrix and Gladiator were probably one or two of them. The Matrix surpassed Lost in Space for having the biggest April and Easter weekends at the box office. I'm sure those have been broken millions of times over since then, but at the time, that was true. At the time, it was the second highest grossing Warner Brothers film ever made, behind Twister, and overall, it was the third highest grossing R-rated film of all time, behind Saving Private Ryan and Terminator 2 Judgment Day. Amazing. Just amazing relics of time. You know, I love looking at old reviews of movies. How have they aged? Roger Ebert gave it 3 out of 4 stars. He praised the film's visuals and premise, but disliked the third act's focus on action. I think Raj got it wrong there. I kind of like the movie more and more as it goes on. The first part's a little dry, a little heavy. And then the second, you're kind of like, oh, what's going on here? Like, in an interesting way, not like in a I'm wandering around confused through this movie way. I think it does a good job of doing that, holding your hand and like, trust me. We're going to reveal everything. If you just stick with us, everything will become clear. Let's talk awards, the only thing that matter. Am I right? 2000 MTV Movie Awards. That's right. That's where we're going to start. Yeah, this movie won a lot of Oscars, but I don't really care about that as much. I think it's more fun to revisit the MTV Movie Awards for whatever reason. Make those fun again. Make the MTV Movie Awards great again. It did win Best Movie. It beat out American Beauty, which won Best Picture at the Oscars, by the way. American Pie, Sixth Sense, and Austin Powers 2. What an odd collection of films. Best Male Performance went to Keanu Reeves for The Matrix. He beat out Jim Carrey for Man on the Moon, Ryan Phillippe for Cruel Intentions, Adam Sandler for Big Daddy, and Bruce Willis for The Sixth Sense. The rooftop scene towards the end of the movie lost Best Action Sequence to the pod racer scene in Star Wars Episode I. That's right. I told you that pod racer scene ruled. Breakthrough Female, Carrie Ann Moss was nominated. She lost to Julia Stiles for 10 Things I Hate About You, came out on the same day. And the kung fu fight between Keanu Reeves and Lawrence Fishburne did win Best Fight at the MTV Movie Awards that year. It did win 4 Oscars. It was nominated for 4 Oscars. It won Best Film Editing, Best Sound Effects, and Best Visual Effects. It batted 1,000 at the Oscars, right? Sorry, I hit the microphone. I don't know if anyone heard that. It batted 1,000. It went 4 for 4, right? That is the most awards while maintaining a perfect record without being nominated for Best Picture in Academy Awards history. No movie has ever won everything it's been nominated for and not been nominated for Best Picture in a way that The Matrix, many thought impossible, but nevertheless. Let's talk about the themes of the movie, and then we'll do best part, unsung heroes. We'll go through my notes app and see all the things I thought of as the movie went on, and then we'll get out of here. The film, obviously, I'm going to say obviously, makes several references to Alice in Wonderland, Follow the White Rabbit probably being like the biggest at the beginning. The 1984 novel Neuromancer by William Gibson, the film's use of the term Matrix comes from that book. And the author of that book actually said, hey, like, don't tell anyone, but I lifted that from a book in the 1960s called The White Room. And, you know, that's where I got the word Matrix from. So like, don't pin this on me, bro. So I told you earlier that when making the movie, before you got to show up on set, you had to read Simulacra and Simulation. Well, the author of that book actually said, hey, The Matrix didn't get it right. It distorted my work, which, wow, man, bold take. Like, I get it. You know, you took the time to write a book. That's really hard. You pour a lot of yourself into that. But I mean, like, don't be mad at The Matrix for like taking your work. And, you know, even if they misinterpreted it, at least they're directing people to your book, right? Like, I guess, right? Am I wrong for that? 2007, Entertainment Weekly called The Matrix the best science fiction piece of media for the past 25 years. I know there's a shifting time window there. It was hard for me to do the math as well. In 2009, Empire Magazine ranked it 39th on its 500 greatest movies, excuse me, of all time list. Okay, time for the superlatives. Let's begin with the best part. I'm going to award this to Neo and Morpheus, the kung fu fighting fight that takes place in between the Matrix and the real world, quote unquote, the real world. It's a great karate fight. Like, obviously, Keanu Reeves would go on to make like the John Wick movies, and there's huge martial arts influences in those. And I think John Wick is some of the best action choreography ever committed to celluloid. I understand they don't do movies on celluloid anymore. They make them digitally, but whatever. Obviously, that fight still holds up. Hot take here. Some of the effects in The Matrix look absolutely horrible nowadays. This movie's streaming on Max. If you didn't watch it before, if you haven't watched it in a long time, a good deal of the effects work in The Matrix looks incredibly, incredibly dated. This kung fu fight scene doesn't look dated because they're both actually doing kung fu. They're slinging around the room on wires, which is something that, like, you wouldn't have Marvel movies without this. We'll get into that, some of the high wire act and the effect The Matrix had on blockbusters. But the best part of the movie to me, the part that holds up the best, is the kung fu fight. Keanu Reeves does the Bruce Lee sniff and, you know, like, hey, come at me, bro, thing. That was improv'd because Keanu said that it would be something somebody who just learned everything about kung fu would do. And wow, what an actor's choice, right? Like, because, yeah, he's dead on. He's dead on. If you learned everything there is to learn about kung fu in 5 minutes, you would absolutely be a cocky SOB and mimic Bruce Lee on the spot. The unsung hero of the movie. Again, this is a movie where I don't think there's a lot of choices. It's either Morpheus or Cypher. And for me, I'm always going to pick the character actor. I'm always going to pick the guy that needs to be highlighted more than one of the three stars of the movie. So I'm going to go Cypher. I'm going to go Joe Pantoliano, who is great in just about everything. I'll bet he has like 150, 200 acting credits to his name. Pretty Woman. Yeah, I don't need to run down the accolades for Joe Pantoliano. The heel turn is great. There's breadcrumbs in the opening scene, let alone throughout the entire movie. The first 6 minutes, you know, they think they're Trinity and Morpheus are talking on the phone, and they're talking about how, oh, I think someone got to the line. Cypher, are you sure this line's clean? And he's like, yeah, of course I'm sure. The way he eats that steak, the way he kills everyone on the Nebuchadnezzar, and he's like, how can he be the one if he's dead? Like, just the way he delivers his lines is so slimy and pompous. It's a great performance from a great character actor. Joe Pantoliano, The Matrix's unsung hero. I'm just going to read the notes in my notes app. We'll see if they make sense. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. We begin. I love the green Warner Brothers logo during the opening credits. I love when a movie studio lets you play with that, because so many times it's, oh no, you can't touch this. Like, don't bother. I love when during the original X-Men movies, yeah, that's right, like the original X-Men movies, the 20th Century Fox logo fades out, but the X stays. Like, I love when movie studios let you play with their logo, because it's more times than not very, very memorable. Less than 5 minutes in, you get that bullet time jump from Carrie Ann Moss. You know, we've talked about bullet time being one of the movie's signature impacts on the movie industry. You get this great feeling two times in the first, I don't know, 30 minutes of the movie. You get this feeling that you know everything that's going on, and then the movie turns on a dime. The opening scene makes a ton of sense, right? And then Trinity runs up the wall, and you're like, what the hell's going on? And like, that happens throughout the whole movie, right? Like, you think you understand the Matrix, and then like halfway through, like, wait, what? So it also takes place on the broad stroke, but it also takes place in these tiny little scenes, like when the interrogation scene, for example. Keanu, it's really the only point in the movie where we get a little bit of Johnny Utah from Point Break. We get a little bit of Jack from Speed. Like, he gives us just a little bit of that bleep you that an action star in the 90s was supposed to have, right? Like, he asks for his phone call, he gives him the finger, and then it changes when they seal his mouth shut. You're like, okay, I think I get what's going on here. They're going to take him back. They're going to explain why they're following him and all that. Oh my gosh, they're gooing his mouth shut. And then, boom, it's a dream sequence, and you're like, wait, okay, so that was all a dream, right? Like, the movie messes with your head. I know this is here later in my notes, so I'll just say it now. It takes you right up to the line where you're going to quit. Like, okay, mentally, maybe this movie's too much for me. I'm going to tap out. It takes you right up to that line, and it always yanks you back just before you feel the need to quit. You get the pill scene with Morpheus and the monologue about the real world being a dream, the scenery constantly changing around him and Neo. And yep, there's my note right there. Takes you right up to the breaking point without actually breaking your brain. It's a lot of information to retain on your first watch, but throughout the movie, Neo sort of serves as the proxy for the audience, where he wants out and they tell him to stay. He's confused, so they have him like, hey, can you explain all this Matrix stuff to me again? And the movie repeats itself. Neo and Morpheus are doing the jumps off the building as a training exercise. I wrote down in my notes app, this reminds me of the end of Space Jam, where the Looney Tunes tell Michael Jordan, hey, you're in a cartoon, just do cartoon stuff. Where they're constantly telling Neo, like, no, you're not in the real world. You need to just believe you can jump 100 feet between buildings and you'll be able to jump 100 feet between buildings. What part of that don't you understand, you idiot? One of the gifts I use on a regular basis, it happens a lot when my sports teams lose in dramatic fashion. I will use the not like this gif. That's one of the lasting impacts of the movie. One of the less fun lasting impacts of the movie is Red Pilled America. Yeah, this movie has elements of it have been taken by political groups who don't understand the movie like at all, but think they do. They think they're really intelligent bros, but they're actually just really date rapey bros. The movie does a good job of presenting its thesis and then actually arguing the other side in the form of the Joe Pantoliano character. Most movies, when they have this big theological idea, they argue their side of the coin without even considering the other side of the coin. So while I was making fun of Red Pilled America and all that stuff, like, I do think the movie does do a good job of both sidesing itself. Like, yeah, you can know everything is a lie, But also, wouldn't that just mess you up irrevocably? Because it would. Like, we ask this question all the time to ourselves, right? Like, hey, in the Matrix, would you take the red pill or the blue pill? Man, I want to stay. I want to stay plugged in. I want to stay, like, life ain't that bad to where I need to, you know, find out what's real and what's not. Ignorance is, in fact, bliss. For me at least. I know everybody feels a little bit differently about that. Another less fun aspect of this movie, people forget this movie was so big and so popular that we blamed a school shooting on this movie. This movie came out less than a month before the tragedy at Columbine High School, and the media blamed the school shooting for... They blamed it on the Matrix. They were like, well, there's a huge shootout scene in the Matrix where they take a lot of guns into a building and shoot up that building and are wearing trench coats. And these kids wore trench coats. So, like, that had to be it, right? Simple as that. It was the trench coats, my man. As much flack as that scene gets for being violent and corrupting generation upon generation of children, not a lot of blood. I think you only actually see one person get shot, and even that is pretty bloodless. Right at the end where the elevator dings and they head up, there's a piece of the pillar that falls off. That wasn't planned, but they thought it looked cool, so they kept it in the movie. I love when stuff like that happens. They're like, you know, it was just kismet, but, you know, we kept it in. It was a cool coincidence. We kept it in. That's a look through my notes apps. We now get into the legacy of the movie. We've talked about bullet time. One of the other things that this movie gets credited with is the internet on screen. The internet as a physical place. This is, if not the first movie, one of the first, one of the biggest, certainly, movies to have the internet as a physical place where characters go. You'll see a lot of times when movies, quote unquote, go inside the internet, it looks similar in a lot of ways to how The Matrix portrayed it. Just like how a lot of zombie movies don't actually say the word zombie, because the first great zombie movie, Night of the Living Dead, they didn't say zombie. Just like in The Matrix, this is what the place looks like. That's what movies have copied off of, because whether they're unoriginal or it's a knowing homage, a wink, if you will, that's how they do it. But this is what I actually think is the movie's biggest legacy. It allowed studios to make intelligent blockbusters. This is an action movie in every sense of the word. Helicopters fly into buildings and explode. By the way, while I'm thinking of planes diving into buildings in this movie, Keanu's passport, fun, not so fun little Easter egg, his passport in the movie, you get a quick glance at it. It expires on September 11th, 2001. Obviously, nobody knew the significance of that date, but going back, it is one of those, whoa, what a horrible coincidence sort of things. But back to the intelligent blockbuster. See, that's why these pods are so long. I do crap like that. I truly, truly believe the Marvel Cinematic Universe doesn't exist without the Matrix existing, because it was the first. Terminator 2 had some of this, but it did sort of get swallowed up by the action in Terminator 2. This is a movie that first half of the movie is almost all exposition. It's hand-to-hand combat. Not a lot of stuff, if anything, blows up in the first bits of the movie. I guess in the opening scene, like one of the building blows up. It's a huge explosion, kind of a important part of the movie. But intelligent blockbusters were always frowned upon. Well, you know, audiences are dumb. There's no way they'd understand something as intelligent as you want to make. This proved that they can A, exist, B, be done well, and C, make a crap ton of money. So studios became more and more okay with blockbusters being intelligent. And I mean, you look at a lot of movies in the MCU, and they're complicated. There's heady themes, and they do it. They let me backtrack that a little bit. They did it very well. If you know me, you know I have Marvel fatigue still after all these years. I'm not ready for a movie from Marvel just yet. Maybe it's because they haven't made a good one in quite a long time, but neither here nor there. Joss Whedon, no stranger to Marvel, called the film his number one, praising the Matrix's storytelling structure and depth, concluding it works on whatever level you want to bring to it. And that's one of the things about the Matrix. If you want it to be super intelligent and all these biblical allegories, all this subtext, it's there if you want it. If you want to turn your brain off and eat some popcorn, you can watch kung fu fights and helicopters fall into buildings and Mr. Anderson's fighting with Mr. Smith in the rain and all that. It doesn't have to be significant at all if you don't want it to be. So it does a great job of working on both levels like that. Darren Aronofsky commented, "I walked out of the Matrix and I was thinking, what kind of science fiction movie can people make now? The Wachowskis basically took all the great sci-fi ideas of the 20th century and rolled them into a delicious pop culture sandwich that everyone on the planet devoured. It allowed ambition to be a part of blockbusters in a way that it hadn't before." And finally, I want to end it on this. Yes, I told you the Marvel Cinematic Universe does not exist without the Matrix. Another, not genre of movie that wouldn't exist, but another director that I believe genuinely would not have a career without the Matrix, Christopher Nolan. Nobody combines high art and popcorn entertainment like Christopher Nolan. He described The Matrix as, quote, "an incredibly palpable mainstream phenomenon that made people think, hey, what if this is real?" Now, let's read that quote a different way. "An incredibly palpable mainstream phenomenon that made people think, full stop." That's what Christopher Nolan's movies do. Incredibly palpable mainstream phenomenon that made people think. The Matrix made it okay for Christopher Nolan to exist. That's my deep dive on The Matrix. How do you like that for an exclamation mark at the end of it? Next week, we're going to do two things. One movie, two things. I will review the new Godzilla vs. Kong, The New Empire, which John Schreiner told me I need to apologize for. I will not apologize for that movie existing. That movie's going to be awesome. It is the exact opposite of The Matrix. It is the antithesis of The Matrix. It is not smart at all. And that's okay, too. There are different avenues for different movies to exist, and that's what I love about the movies. They're all so different. And I also love the potential that anytime you watch a movie for the first time, it can be the best movie you've ever seen in your life. Now, it rarely is, but I love that possibility. I love that potential. And we will celebrate the 70th anniversary of the original Japanese Godzilla from 1954. It is streaming on Max. If you do not like subtitles in your movie, that is okay. You can watch Godzilla King of the Monsters, also streaming on Max. They're the same movie. One's the Japanese version, one's the American version. I will tell you the Japanese version is better if you've never seen it. Now, obviously, while we celebrate the 70th anniversary of the original Godzilla, we will dive into a lot of the sequels from Japan that were in America. Yes, we'll talk about the 1998 Matthew Broderick Godzilla for just a little bit. We'll talk about this new string of Godzilla versus Kong movies. The one, you know, the Godzilla with Bryan Cranston. People forget he was in that movie. Kong Skull Island, Godzilla King of the Monsters with the new one with Ice Cube's kid in it. We'll talk about all those and the original Godzilla next time we're here together on Producer Josh's Film School.